In a world of need, we need medical care. Without delay.
Delay.
Without bias. Without bureaucracy. Without prejudice. Without violence.
Civilians are not expendable.
Without apathy. Without division. That's why we need Doctors Without Borders. Save lives at msf.org.au.
This podcast is supported by Brisbane Economic Development Agency. When Ulta Steel CEO Paul Zuckerman chose Brisbane for Australia's first low-carbon steel mill, Brisbane Economic Development Agency, BEDA, was there from day one.
BEDA was an early relationship for us, and they've just been so supportive. I think they're great at connecting businesses and really just open doors for us.
Brisbane Economic Development Agency connect business, research and government with opportunity. Search Choose Brisbane for more information.
This is The Guardian.
I'm Jo Tovey, coming to you from Gadigal land. And this is the full story, newsroom edition. A centrist Labor Prime Minister, who won his last election decisively, went on to face declining polls and an insurgent anti-immigration party. No, I'm not talking about Anthony Albanese, but rather his friend Keir Starmer, who this week succumbed to mounting pressure and resigned as UK Prime Minister. A number of comparisons have been made between the pair this week, but beyond a few superficial points, are there real parallels here? And what lessons, if any, can be learned from Starmer's downfall? With me to discuss this week is Gabrielle Jackson.
Hi, Jo. It's almost impossible to watch this play out and not compare it to what's happening here, so looking forward to this discussion.
And Mike Tisha.
Hi, Jo. Yes, there was a time when the UK looked at us in bewilderment at us changing prime ministers before they'd even been to a second election, but now the shoe is definitely on the other foot.
And joining us for the first time is Guardian Australia foreign editor, Virginia Harrison.
Hi, Jo. Nice to be here.
I want to start with diagnosing why Starmer was in such an untenable position that he stepped down on Monday. Now, it's never one thing, but how do you understand it, Virginia?
No, that's right. It wasn't one thing at all. So if we go back to 2024, Labor came to power in a landslide. There was optimism and high hopes for Starmer, and he was seen as calm and competent. But really, Labor wasn't elected because they were hugely popular. It was that the Conservatives were very unpopular. Voters had seen years of scandal and chaos under the Tories, and they wanted a change. So that was the starting point, and there were lots of other problems for Starmer. He wasn't a great communicator. He wasn't able to set out a clear policy plan or a strategy. So in his first big speech, Starmer came out and he said, things will get worse before they get better.
Inspiring stuff.
Yeah. And it really set the tone, and it was a mood that he found hard to shift. He talked about painful taxes and spending cuts and all those things, and he did go on to make unpopular decisions like cutting the winter fuel payment and did a long sort of list of U-turns, and none of that helped him. And then there were lots of other issues and scandals like appointing Peter Mandelson as US ambassador. Mandelson was later sacked over his ties to Jeffrey Epstein. And all of this is going on alongside the continued rise of reform. And eventually it all led to Starmer resigning. And now here we are today looking like Andy Burnham will take over.
Mm. Gabs or Mike, do either of you have other views on what led him to step down?
I think the backdrop of Brexit also can't be discounted. You know, there are estimates that the UK economy has shrunk between 4 and 8% because of the withdrawal from the EU. And that came after the global financial crisis and the austerity measures which followed that, which really devastated a lot of social services, led to really deep declines in people's living standards in a way that it's hard to understand in Australia. We were just not affected by the GFC like the UK was and didn't have the same kind of austerity measures that have really affected people's quality of life.
Mm. His downfall comes despite some policy wins though, right? Like, for example, on the NHS, waiting times are down. That was a core promise.
part of his problem and inability, do you think, to communicate or sell his wins, sell his vision?
Yeah, I think, as you mentioned, he did have some wins, the minimum wage stuff, workers' rights were strengthened, the waiting list came down, he made gains in child poverty.
And half a million kids lifted out of child poverty. Yeah, it's a pretty big achievement.
A huge achievement. And even on immigration, which is sort of a tricky issue in the UK, you know, the numbers have fallen as well. I think, as you say, it's kind of what we've talked about. Some of his other problems just got in the way and really overshadowed things. He didn't connect with voters. He just failed to set out a clear vision and just didn't seem to have a good command of his party. And all of these things, that's what plagued him. And he just couldn't quite get out from under that. And I don't know how that sits with the Australian context, but certainly that's what we saw with Starmer.
Mm. Now, in the minds of many, Albanese and Starmer are closely linked. That's partly kind of a few superficial factors we mentioned. They're sort of their age, they're centrist Labor leaders. They're also closely aligned with each other. They're friends by their own description. But as prime ministers, do you think they actually have much in common?
I think they do, to the extent that they both came into that election promising to kind of bring us calm, steady as she goes, reassuring presence after years of chaos vibe. But Starmer kind of undermined that a lot by some of the things that Virginia's described, changing his mind on policy, like announcing one thing, going back on it, and just making things worse by doing U-turns on things that had been previously announced. And also, yes, just failing to sort of outsourcing some of my commentary on the communication factor to our UK columnist. Jonathan Friedland was talking about this and said that communication is not some kind of presentational add-on. It's essential to the task of political leadership. I think that's really true. It's just about making a compelling argument. Our other columnist, Raphael Baer, wrote that communications failure starts with ill-designed policy. Authenticity flows from surety of purpose. It's hard to sell something with a sincere passion when you don't really know what it's for. And I think that is a real difference with Albanese. He's not an inspiring,
he's no Obama,
uplifting, rhetorical kind of guy. But Labour here, I think, do know what they're doing in the sense of they know where they want to get to. They've got clearly set out goals and they're putting in place policy that tries to achieve them, not without some bumps in the road, obviously. But Starmer's problem was that it was very unclear where they wanted to go, even though despite some of the positive things they did do, they never had that narrative of trying to lift people up.
And I think the difference is that, you know, Albanese has been in politics. He was in Parliament for 25 years before he became Prime Minister. Even though he's not a great communicator, I don't think many people question his motivations for being Prime Minister. He's been very clear about what he wanted to achieve. But more importantly, I think the bigger difference rather than similarity is he has such control of his party. He knows how Parliament works. He's a numbers man. He understands Parliament in and out, and he's been able to keep his party really disciplined, but he's also a bit of a schmoozer. Like he knows who to keep on side to get what he wants. So we've seen the Labour Party here function a bit better than the Labour Party in the UK.
And he seems to be surrounded by a much better team. A lot of the downfall of Starmer has been blamed on his advisor, Morgan McSweeney, whereas Albanese, on the other hand, has a very senior chief advisor in Tim Gartrell. Paul Erickson has been widely credited as sort of masterminding the last Labour election campaign. So as well as the sort of personal control that Albanese is able to exercise, loyalty of the senior team around him, he's also got that staff backup, which I think is a real difference and something our political editor, Tom McElroy, has been looking at this week.
I think it's interesting that UK Labour was so inspired by that first 2022 election win that they actually did some workshops with UK Labour and the Labour team here before they went to their election. And one thing they did was have a really small target and ruled out lots of tax changes. The difference is they did that here too, but then changed their mind.
I think there is a difference. This might be trying to introduce too much nuance, but there's a difference between the way Labour changed their mind on the tax changes that they've just got a way to get through Parliament this week and the way that Starmer's Labour Party would announce that they were doing an unpopular policy and then change their minds after the backlash. Whereas here, it's more like they've thought it through, decided they're going to have to go back on an election promises twice now on the stage three tax cuts as well. They've thought through what the upsides and downsides of that might be, how they, we think anyway, it remains to be seen, but how they're going to sell it to the public and what the implications of that might be, who's going to win, who's going to lose, and made a conscious sort of hard-nosed decision about changing a policy that they'd previously not supported. Whereas in the UK, it felt much more like flip-flopping in the face of public opinion and the media and criticism they were getting and so on. I don't know. Well, Virginia, maybe.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. It did feel kind of reactive to all sorts of different forces. And again, just comes back to this idea of no clear vision, no clear strategy, not sticking to a path, just kind of fumbling.
And blind by the winds. Yeah,
yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I think on the stage three tax cuts, they did that very well. There was a lot of conversation about how unfair they were. Chalmers is a great communicator. He talked about it for a long time. He was slapped down, he came back, and eventually it passed and no one noticed. And I think if they had have made the negative gearing changes and capital gains tax discount changes just on housing, they would have won and it would have been easy. But I think people were really surprised by the trust changes and the extent the capital gains tax discount would affect small businesses. And I think they didn't do the work on those changes. And that's why there has been so much opposition. Mm. It will be interesting to see how that plays out.
Yeah, we shouldn't overstress the competence and all knowingness of the Australian Labor Party. They do make bad mistakes as well.
Yeah.
But just to go back on the theme of sort of party unity, I think that's a really clear difference where in the UK, particularly the Mandelson affair, but other of the policy questions that you mentioned earlier, Virginia, there's been a lot of unhappiness in the parliamentary party and in the membership of the British Labour Party about the direction of the government. Whereas here, the parliamentary party has been pretty much, for 4 years, has been pretty much rock solid. They've had a bit of dissension. Even the Gaza and the Israel situation hasn't really set off a huge unhappiness to the extent that, certainly not to the extent that Albanese's position as leader has been.
No, there's been no leadership rumblings, which is the true key.
You're always going to have people unhappy, and there are people who are very unhappy with the direction they're taking. But at the top of the cabinet level and in the parliamentary party, they put on a good public face.
Yeah. It goes back to your first point, Mike, about the Brits watching us go through all of our leadership dramas of the 2010s. But I think that has really shaped the decade that's followed, where parties are very reluctant to change prime minister mid-race. The public hated it. It didn't serve anybody. That is not the case in the UK. There's a clear parallel as well in the political climate that both prime ministers are faced with, where there's these formerly fringe right-wing parties that have leapfrogged the traditional conservative parties largely on an anti-immigration platform. How did Starmer deal with or not deal with reform, and how did that go for him?
Yeah, so reform says Britain is broken, it wants to freeze immigration, and it's now the most popular party in the UK. So this is the party led by Nigel Farage, and early last year they overtook Labour for the first time in a national poll, and they've led the polls ever since. So it's been steadily gaining ground, particularly through the last year of Starmer's leadership. And one way they tried to fight reform was by appealing to some right-wing voters with kind of like tough rhetoric, immigration policies. But in doing so, it sort of managed to lose some of its progressive voters. Some went to the Lib Dems and the Green Party. And at the same time, reform has just kept rising in the polls. So Starmer then tried to wind this back a little bit, but it didn't really succeed. And then we had local elections in May, where Labor saw its worst defeat ever in terms of local elections, and reform and the Greens made some big gains. So in terms of, you know, what worked, it hasn't really worked for Starmer, and we are where we are now with him. And now Labor hopes that Andy Burnham can take on reform. And his success in the Makerfield by-election is kind of seen as proof that he might be able to do that, because he did win. He was successful in kind of beating off not just reform, but restore this new far-right party that formed as well. The hopes are that Andy Burnham can kind of succeed against that rising right-wing force in a way that Starmer wasn't able to.
There was that quite alienating speech, wasn't there, that Starmer made about not wanting to see Britain become an island of strangers in rhetoric that echoed Enoch Powell, which I think was just
People saw it as such a betrayal.
Yeah.
And a lot of progressives couldn't come back from that.
It's interesting to contrast that with how Labor are going about tackling Pauline Hanson on One Nation here. It's taken them a while to come to the way they think might work best. But I did think we saw this week, after her speech at the National Press Club last week, that they are going to be much more comfortable sending a positive message about multiculturalism and Australia as a migrant nation, which it is.
Her call for a monoculture was really, frankly, kind of a gift to
I think so.
Labor.
While still talking about reducing immigration, which is, you know, immigration numbers have gradually been coming down, and Labor's been talking about wanting to bring them down further, which is a reasonable policy position, but without imbuing it with all the really unpleasant rhetoric about migrants themselves. And I think that's roughly where they should be in taking on One Nation.
Yeah, and Albanese did mount something of a defence of multiculturalism this week when asked in a press conference, which has been really widely aired even on Sky News. So I think when he does fight, he can get a message across.
Mm. It did take them a while. I thought it was interesting. Yeah. It wasn't really till this week that they muscled up, and it wasn't really until Angus Taylor refused to back multiculturalism that they saw the very clear opening to be the defenders of a multicultural Australia.
And you have to be positive about this, right? You have to sort of sell that message in some positive way, not just say we want to keep migration's level down because, you know, we don't really like migrants.
But I mean, it's also absolutely ludicrous comparing Australia to Japan. I mean, we are an immigrant nation, and that's what Albanese said this week. We have never been a monoculture. Mm. Even before European invasion, First Nations countries were not a monoculture.
Yeah.
There has never been such a thing. It is so ridiculous.
And even in colonisation, we had a good piece this week on the diversity on the First Fleet, the people from not just sort of different Anglo-Celtic cultures, but from other parts of Europe. It's a fiction. I want to just go back to briefly talking about Andy Burnham, who, as you've said, is widely expected to succeed Starmer as PM. One of the dominant narratives that's emerging about him is that he's a better communicator. He's likeable. He can talk to people in ways that Starmer simply could not. Is he also an agent of change? And are we going to see a sort of a different vision, a different direction, or just the same government with a different, more likable face, do you think, Virginia?
Yeah, I think that, well, there's a big question mark over that, I think, at the moment. As you say, a lot of his success in Makerfield and so far in kind of rising to what we expect to be the next Prime Minister has been put down to his personal qualities, you know, the so-called King of the North. He is a good communicator. He does connect with people. And some people in the Labor Party really see him as the answer to the problem they have in terms of losing support in the traditional working class strongholds. And there's a sense that he might be able to bring together tactical voters that want to just block Nigel Farage. So all of that is playing in his favour. But I guess there's a couple of things going on. One being that the big win in Makerfield happened at a local scale, and there's still a big question over whether he can replicate that kind of success and connect with people and have the same impact at the national scale. And also the second thing, as you sort of point to, Labor still faces huge policy challenges around spending, welfare, the economy, all those things. And it's not clear yet how he's going to take that on and overcome all those challenges that were faced by Starmer. We don't know a lot yet about his policy plan. I mean, he's not in yet. So we're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit. But the reporting, including some reporting around today, is indicating that devolution will be a big part of it. He's apparently planning to move parts of Number 10 to Manchester, you know.
Like the Guardian.
So maybe that direction does kind of connect and work and put him in different sort of place to Starmer, but just put a big question mark over how successful he's going to be.
The kind of charisma is really obvious. I mean, when he walked into Parliament and someone shouted, "You're not the Messiah," and he kind of quipped, "Naughty boy." Like, it's just, you can't imagine Keir Starmer responding or anyone yelling that out. But it was kind of funny and heartwarming, and people were cheering. And it's very hard not to kind of get a little bit excited.
But I also think, like, he's only going to go one way, isn't he? He's only going to get less popular. Like, there's all of this sort of but he is. You know, that's what happens to everyone. Why would this person be any different, you know? So I don't know. I don't know if we're sort of overstating and being a little bit too excited about this man that's going to save Britain.
I agree. You don't want to read too much off that single result.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, he's coming off a low base in the polls. Like, they're at 18%.
Mm.
He doesn't have to get much better. Like, 20s is not a great result historically, but it might be enough to win another election by a slim margin.
I want to just briefly touch on Australian politics this week. We've talked about a little bit. Labor had a big win in securing the Green support for their contentious changes to property taxes. Now, they've been getting a lot of heat over this budget, although I thought it was quite interesting to see the first poll in the Nine newspapers this week showed the general public was very sanguine about falling property prices in cities like Sydney, suggesting that while the budget's been unpopular, at least some of the media backlash about that potential consequence has been out of step. Do you guys think this has been a good week for the government and for Albanese's leadership more generally?
I think it's probably has, yes. Getting agreement from the Greens to pass the tax changes is a necessary first step for them. And I do think it's going to be really super interesting to see how those house price changes play out. Obviously, there's one big constituency that thinks it's great, people who want to buy a house, and there's another probably larger one who doesn't think it's great. People already own a house.
So the poll suggested potentially a lot of homeowners must be in that column thinking that it's not a bad thing to see house prices fall. Maybe people with kids who think.
Exactly. You know. It just depends on your situation, whether you're planning to sell soon or, but if you plan to sell and buy, then maybe it doesn't, swings and roundabouts. But yeah, I think that's uncertain how that will affect people's view of the government. But yes, I think it was a good week, but they've got a long way to go to sell those tax changes because they are still not popular in the polls. Mm. And people might like what it's done to house prices, but that's not the same as necessarily think the government's done a good thing.
As I said before, I think they did win the housing argument. They haven't won the small business argument. Yeah. And that's where the narrative will play out now. And it's almost like it doesn't matter which parts of it people like and don't like, as long as there's this kind of hysterical media attention on how bad the budget was, that may end up being a really bad thing for them.
Mm. It has been quite a bad week, though, for their opponents, you'd have to say, between Angus Taylor's multiculturalism flubs, Pauline Hanson's MP voting with the Greens on legislation related to the mining industry. So
yeah, I think it has been a good week for Labor. I think the story that Dan Jovis Bardi and Josh Butler did this week on the Liberal backlash against Taylor, you know, the first rumblings of whether he's really measuring up is quite interesting. I think, as you said, the win with the deal with the Greens was quite good. And I think standing up for multiculturalism will also play well with Labor's base.
All right, we might take a quick break and then we'll be right back.
In a world of need, we need medical care. Without delay. Without bias. Without bureaucracy. Without prejudice. Without violence.
Civilians are not expendable.
Without apathy. Without division. That's why we need Doctors Without Borders. Save lives at msf.org.au.
Full Story is supported by EY Parthenon. EY Parthenon is the global strategy consulting practice of EY, working with CEOs, boards, investors, and governments on their most critical decisions. They bring deep sector expertise, an investor mindset, and advanced technology to bring clarity to complex challenges. EY Parthenon helps leaders make better decisions in moments of change, anticipating what's next, finding opportunity in uncertainty, and translating complex shifts into real-world outcomes, turning insight into action. For more insights, go to ey.com/au/Parthenon. EY Parthenon, transformative strategy and transactions. Solutions that work in practice, not just on paper.